Welcome to the Retzel Health Law Hotspot. Health Law Hotspot is a podcast for physicians and health professionals that covers the legal issues and trends that affect the healthcare industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Health Law Hotspot. I'm Erica Adler, shareholder and leader of our healthcare practice at Retzel and Andrus. And today I'm joined by Ike Devji, who's the founder and managing attorney of Arizona Wealth Law and Pro Asset Protection. Today, we're going to be talking about a great topic, which is essentially the malpractice risk that's faced by physicians and what they can do to both minimize that and to protect themselves from an asset perspective, meaning what should they do knowing that malpractice risk is out there in order to protect their assets. Ike is going to be talking to us about this in detail, and he brings with him 18 years of experience where he and his colleagues have protected over $5 billion in personal assets for a national client base that includes thousands of physicians, including a dozen in his own family among a larger client base. Ike is a national educator and speaks and publishes nationally on these topics. And we're really excited to have him with us today. So welcome, Ike.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you. I appreciate you sharing some of your time.
Well, I appreciate you being here, especially because this is a really important topic. As you know, we work with a variety of different types of professionals, physicians, dentists, and other types of professionals. And malpractice, obviously, is a big concern. But I think there's probably not enough thought given to how they're protecting their assets and whether they're getting the proper guidance that they should be getting from the advisors that they're working with. So first of all, why don't we start by you kind of talking to us a little bit about medical malpractice risk and asset protection, and kind of how big a risk is it really?
Well, it's a great place to start. So we know statistically in this country that most physicians will be sued for some professional liability issue, medical malpractice. Somewhere between 1.75 and 2.25 times during their practice life. That's the average, right? So at least once, some are going to get sued at least once, most are going to get sued twice or more, depending on how long they've been in practice and how many years in practice they have. And the longer you practice, obviously, the greater the statistical odds are. It is a risk for all doctors, but some specialties are obviously higher risk than others, right? And that's reflected in everything from what they charge for their services and how they're compensated to the medical malpractice premiums that docs pay, right? So we know that, for instance, some of the highest risk specialties that get sued the most often are general surgeons, urologists, OB-GYNs, general surgeons, radiologists, emergency medicine, cardiology, gastroenterology, and anesthesiology. Those are the top 10. And so, we're always looking at those, but every doc has some of that risk. And of course, some states are riskier and much more litigious than other states. And it's not always the states that we think, right? We think of big cities, big lawsuits, greedy personal injury lawyers, and it's all coming from these big population centers. But for instance, the state with the highest number of medical malpractice claims is Kentucky, followed by Florida, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Illinois. Those round out the top five. And there's, we have a list of the top 10, and we can share some of these details with your viewers as well in another form. But that risk is always out there. Premiums have been going up. Lawsuit awards are getting bigger every year. In 2018, as one example, the last time there was a very good, well-documented study on these issues that's done every so many years, over $4 billion was paid out in 2018. So this is a business. The business of suing doctors is a very profitable business for attorneys who are in that field. I mean, it's $4 billion a year. And a lot of this is attorney driven. And the amount of annual payouts has increased every year for the last 6 years. And one other thing that I'll finish with this, at least in response to this question, is that we have a lot of docs and their advisors say, well, most claims are settled. And that's absolutely true. The majority of medical malpractice claims are settled by the carrier and the physician with the plaintiff without going to trial, and only about 4% go to trial. But that 4% results in an additional $150 million a year in payouts from court judgments. So that's sort of the risk picture that we're looking at. And it's important that anyone we talk to understands that.
Wow. And I know one of the doctor's biggest fears always is to get sued in a Med-Mal case. And that's something I talk about with my clients a lot. But I know that you're concerned not only about medical malpractice risk, but also other types of risks. So what other kinds of risks should doctors and other healthcare professionals be thinking about?
That's a great question. And it's a common blind spot for docs, right? You and I understand that physicians have this very reasonable concern about professional liability. But especially for physician practice owners, and we'll get into some other details, they not only have the regular medical risk, the patient-centric risk, but they have the same business risk, and I know you do a ton of work in this area, that every other business owner in America has, right? They have data security risk, they have employment law risk. Employers are 5 times more likely to be sued by an employee in the United States than for any other reason. And the average sexual harassment verdict, as just one example, is over $500,000, right? When we talk to people, we warn doctors not to suffer from self-inflicted risk myopia. I used to have a little diagram or a drawing that I'd put in my CME presentations with a doctor who was a cyclops, right? Had the physician with the white coat and the stethoscope and one big eye. And the only thing that person was looking at was their Med-Mal risk. And we advise doctors to think of themselves holistically as people, as executives, as business owners, as real estate owners, as investors, in addition to their professional risks. So we ask basic questions. Do you own a home? Do you drive a car? Do you serve on a board, a public or private board of a hospital or a school or your religious institution or a bank or other places that like to attract doctors? Because having somebody with the MD initials on the board of your company brings legitimacy, right? That's why physicians are solicited for these things. So we want to make sure that they're considering those things. We want to make sure that they are protecting themselves from the risk of liability generating assets. Maybe our physician also owns a building or a series of rental homes or a commercial property. How is that being held, and are they properly protected from that risk? And a big one, I know you and your firm do a ton of M&A work for physicians and help physicians transition out of practices. A big overlooked risk is for those who are selling a practice or a business, and it might be their medical business, or it might be their interest in a surgical center or a lab or an imaging center, some of the other things that physicians love to invest in. If you're selling your business and replacing that recurring income with a very significant single lump sum, is that being adequately protected? And are you protected from the biggest threat in every exit strategy, in every exit plan, which is the buyer, right? So that's just a few of the risk factors. And look, owning homes, owning cars, having children who drive our cars, owning investment real estate, these are all fairly common things. None of these risks that I named are exotic, but we need to make sure that any plan is holistic and looks at the physician as that three-dimensional being, not as a one-dimensional doctor. Does that make sense the way I'm saying that?
Absolutely. And I mean, I know that malpractice is very common, but the types of issues that we deal with our practice clients every day, you know, are the things that occur much more frequently than malpractice claims, right? We have employees, definitely age discrimination, sexual harassment. We have employee dishonesty and theft. We have investigation by the DEA, by the licensing board, by Medicare, you know. So there are many other risks that doctors in particular are facing that happen more frequently and are probably more likely to occur than malpractice risks. And you're absolutely right. But the doctors are really afraid of malpractice, and I completely understand that. You know, it's kind of taken a life of its own. I mean, especially, I don't know if you've seen this, but in a lot of contracts now, they give up any right to negotiate the malpractice claim, to have a right as to whether something is settled or not settled, et cetera. So I think it's become even more scary for them and even more of a focus. And then of course, even if a claim is settled, it's reportable to the National Practitioner Data Bank, right? Which is then something that follows them even further down the road every time they apply for staff privileges or every time they try and get a license in a new state. So it just seems this malpractice fear is just so huge, and it goes to the very essence of who they are, which is a licensed professional. So I understand, but statistically speaking, you're absolutely right. It is more likely they're going to face other challenges than malpractice itself. So
yes, and they need to be protected against all of those exposures.
Right.
And fortunately, good asset protection planning is 360 degrees in its scope, right? It protects all of the things that you have done the right thing with at the right time from any future exposure. Right. But that also means that we have to have all the right layers in place to protect somebody properly. And those layers include more than just the right medical malpractice policy with the right features. And you touched on some of those.
Perfect. So in terms of the layers of asset protection, let's kind of dive into that just a little bit, because I know that's something that you like to talk about. So tell us a little bit more about these layers.
You bet. So, you know, asset protection is sort of like wellness, right? It's not just one thing. And so we say that asset protection works best as a system of three layers. And this is a way that I've found to explain it to physicians and to other attorneys to whom I teach on this subject. So the first layer is what I euphemistically refer to as clean living, right? And what that really means is compliance. It means let's not do things that get us sued, and let's not let others for whom we bear responsibility do those things either. And that could be our staff, that could be the partners in our practice, that could be our spouses, that could be our children, right? Depending on what the circumstance is. So let's look at always maintaining compliance, following the standards of care, following best practices, and avoiding the harm. And for physicians, in the specific context of what you and I are here to talk about today, medical malpractice, the first two layers of that compliance and clean living are diagnosis and documentation. Those are a physician's first two lines of defense against a med mal claim. And, you know, we've talked for years, you know, the insurance industry came up with this phrase, defensive medicine, many years ago, right? And that was a pejorative that described physicians that were using diagnostic tools to protect themselves and make sure that they'd done a good job. And of course, the objection from the payer side is, we don't want to pay for all of those tests. And I absolutely, and you and I both understand, that physicians should not abuse those things. They should not over-test, but they should use every option reasonably at their disposal to make sure that they have thoroughly diagnosed anything that could reasonably be a threat to the patient's health and safety. And they should carefully document everything they've done. And, you know, you and I are both active on social media. We're both connected to a bunch of physicians on social media. And I'm sure you see a lot of the same horror stories I do, where we have oncologists and radiologists and other specialists saying that I spent 3 hours on the phone today trying to get pre-approval for this test, right? Those are folks who are doing a good job. They're advocating for their patients. They are also, intentionally or not, engaging in risk management. And that's something that, you know, that's a huge part of this. Let's, you know, the best fight ever fought is the one never fought, right? That's one of the first rules in the martial arts, for instance, is avoid the fight when you can. Let's not have this fight if we don't have to. And if it does happen, let's make sure we're prepared. In fact, you know, if we look at the 10 most common causes of medical malpractice claims, a lot of them revolve around these issues, diagnosis and documentation. So failure to diagnose accounts for a full 33% of all medical malpractice claims. We look at other things like poor documentation of patient instruction is 4%, incorrect administration of medication, 3%, failure to follow safety procedures, 2%, and lack of consent is another 1 or 2%, right? So those, let's remove those kind of technical, almost administrative details from care before we get to things like poor outcome and things that are much more subjective about the patient's condition or the skill of the physician, right, who is implementing something. There's some basic stuff here like diagnosis and documentation that we can do that will reduce the likelihood of anyone you and I are ever working with very significantly. So does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's, it's common sense. I guess doctors all understand this and know this. And I think it's just sometimes the overwhelming nature of day-to-day practice operations, the challenges on their time, the number of patients they have to see per hour. And I think they all know this and they all want to achieve this. And I think sometimes we have to remind ourselves that we need to go back and make sure we didn't lose sight of those goals, right? Because of the challenge of day-to-day practice. It's almost like a constant battle. You want to do these things, but you're being pushed from all sides, the payors, your employer, your EMR system, your day-to-day oversight of the practice management needs, et cetera. It's really hard to do perfect at everything. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we need to pay a little bit more attention to these things, and maybe we have to, find the time to achieve these goals. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think you really hit the nail on the head there. There are so many pressures that providers are facing, and a time pressure is all of those different pressures result in a time pressure, right? Especially when it comes to errors being made in documentation and omissions of documentation. Those right. things are usually due to the realistic, constraints of the time pressure. And you get what the reality is. I get what the reality is. The doctors that are listening certainly know it better than you or I ever will. But that doesn't make it any less vital that physicians, their staff, their organizations take a step back and look at this as risk management, as vital risk management to protect the practice, right? The doctor's job is to protect the patient and serve the patient. My job is to protect the doctor. And so I've got to make sure that we're saying the right things and reinforcing, as you said, these things that physicians already know, but that need to be verbalized and need to be reminded of in some cases. So that's the first layer of asset protection we refer to as I said, clean living and compliance. The second layer of asset protection is an insurance program. And we always stress that, again, insurance is a program, not a policy. So yes, it is vital that every physician have a medical malpractice policy. We do see still some physicians, especially in some southern states, that practice bare or practice with the statutory minimums. Right. I think that's financial suicide. I think the 1-3 policy that the majority of American doctors carry is the minimum that should be in place. Obviously there are people that are in certain specialties where the stakes are higher, and in some cases they go beyond that. But that 1-3 is kind of the national standard. And then are those who are below that. And it brings up the myth of self-insurance, right? And I tell people there is no such thing as self-insured, with maybe the exception of folks who have a captive, right? Which is true self-insurance in some sense. But I tell folks you are either insured or uninsured. And that means that you are on the line not only for the costs of a judgment and the liability that it could produce, but the very significant costs of medical malpractice defense, right? And you look at experts, depositions, witnesses, records, all of that, it's easily hundreds of thousands of dollars on top of the liability of the judgment itself. So it's vital that every doctor has medical malpractice insurance. and that they understand the features of that policy. And you touched on a bunch of these issues just a few minutes ago. So we wanted them to know about consent to settle and hammer clauses. Can your carrier settle a case without your consent and thereby generate all of those provider reporting issues and data bank issues and all the other things that you touched on so eloquently and so succinctly a minute ago? Do they have the ability to do that? Does your policy include defense inside the limits of the policy or in addition to the limits of the policy? And what that essentially means in the simplest layperson's terms is that if you have $1 million policy that includes defense inside the limits, the $300,000 that company spends on the lawyers comes off your $1 million. That only leaves $700 for an actual judgment. That's one very simple example. Whereas a defense in addition to the policy pays the cost of defense and leaves that limit whole. We also want to make sure that you understand if the policy limits are shared with other exposures, right? So we've talked about, I started this discussion of this second layer of asset protection being insurance and saying that we need layers of insurance. So that means not only a med-mal policy, but a policies that cover all of the other issues you touched upon a minute ago. You talked about employment law risk. You talked about RAC audit risk. You talked about data breach and cyber liability risk for HIPAA exposure, right? All of those things should be covered. And I make my practice owners, or I suggest at least, I don't sell insurance, but I ask them to consider, for instance, for practice owners, having at least $1 million in coverage on each of those issues, $1 million for employment law, $1 million for data breach, $1 million for RAC audit, and in some cases, $1 million or more for D&O insurance, directors and officers insurance. Now, those policies should not share the limit of your medical malpractice policy and should be standalone policies. But when I ask most doctors if they have coverage in those areas, what they either say is no, or they go and check and they come back and say, yeah, we're covered. And I'll say, great. Are you covered with standalone policies that are separate from your medical malpractice policy limits? Or do these share the limits of that policy? And are they simply low limit riders that somebody has added to your policy? Yeah, you've got medical malpractice, you've got employment law coverage, you've got data breach coverage, you've got D&O coverage, and you've got $50,000 in each of those. Well, you and I both know that how long does $50,000 go in litigation? Not very far, right? I mean, when we're talking about when we have to take a client in and put them in front of an attorney for defense on any one of these issues, they're going to put down a $10,000 retainer payment day one.
Yep.
Right. So when you look at the costs of all of these different policies, in one case, I had a cardiology practice buy all four or five of those different policies in addition to what they were carrying. And the total premium was about $15,000 a year. So that added $5 million in additional coverage, $1 million for each of those things. And they didn't want to pay for it. And I said, it's your decision, doc, but do realize that if you have an exposure on any one of those issues, you will write a $15,000 check day one, and you will continue to write those checks where we could have been protected against all of this for that one payment.
Right, absolutely.
So it is, I get that it's not exciting to pay for one more kind of insurance or five more kinds of insurance, but the cost-benefit ratio is off the charts when we look at what will insurance do for you. And as we said, it's not just the judgment, it's also the defense cost that we need to keep an eye on. So that's sort of the insurance story as well. So first, we're going to try to avoid the harm. Second, we're going to be insured against accidents, mistakes, human error, whatever the case may be. And then the third layer of asset protection is the legal tools, the things that folks like you and I put in place. And, you know, doctors and every other business owner in America have an ethical and legal right to organize their assets before there is a problem. And this is probably the most single most important thing on any asset protection discussion. It is ethical and legal if implemented in advance of a crisis. I unfortunately turn away several people a month who call me or are who are referred to me after something bad has happened, after they've lost a patient, after their kid has run someone over with the car, after they and their two partners are suing each other over the surgery center they all invested in.
Right.
It's too late, right? At that point, what was good estate planning, business planning, asset protection planning that is conventional, legal, ethical, suddenly becomes fraud. So we have a legal right to plan against the entire world under a blue sky, but never against one specific risk or plaintiff that has already occurred. And so, you know, this goes far beyond what traditional estate planning, like putting your assets in a revocable living trust, can provide. And a revocable living trust is a great tool. It's a vital tool. It's a great estate planning tool. I have one. You probably have one. We put them in place for clients, but we make sure that they understand that using those family trusts, as they're referred to, is zero creditor protection from your liabilities during your life. So we need to have the right tools in place. We need to separate assets and liabilities. We need to make sure that if you have a high value home, which has very high equity above your state's homestead, that it's protected. We need to make sure that if you have investment real estate, that you are protected from the internal risk of that real estate, and that real estate is protected from your risk as a doctor, right? So the physician should not own significant assets in their own name. They should be in the appropriate legal tools. And it requires somebody with a certain degree of experience to show you what tools to use to draft those tools appropriately and to make sure that those tools are defensible if they're ever challenged in a crisis, right? So, and all of this has to be done in advance. And that is a little counterintuitive to us culturally, right? In America, most Americans spend more time and money on triage and crisis management than on risk management and prevention, right? So it is cheaper and more predictable to do these things when you have a legal right to than afterwards. So you can take your taxable assets and investment accounts and put them in a wrapper. You can put your investment real estate or your investment in other income producing activities into a system where the income comes in safely and is protected, right? And again, it just takes knowing what to do and doing it at the right time.
Right. I think that's amazing advice. And, you know, I work often with young doctors and I'm always telling them, I know you're about to take your first job and you're going to start earning a nice paycheck. Now is the time. And it's not just time to think about asset protection if they're buying their first house, whatever, but also other types of insurance type products, things like disability insurance, because, you know, the number one thing I find is that a doctor who's sick and disabled and can't practice medicine really does not know what else to do with himself or herself and never thought about that possibility. And without that disability insurance, it can just destroy, you know, everything the doctor has saved up and worked for, et cetera. So the time to have the conversation, not only about these asset protection issues, about malpractice, but about other potential life events is sooner than later. And preferably if you're a young doc, now, do it now, right? Which is before anything has happened. And I think sometimes they just feel like they can't afford it, or, you know, they have to just focus on their job and they don't really have time for that. And there's no, I don't have time for it, right? You can't, there's really no mentality where there's anything more important than protecting your assets, which is the same as protecting your family, your livelihood, your reputation, right? So these things kind of all come together. I think that's just amazing advice. I know I touch on a lot of these topics with my clients. Certainly I'm not in the same area of expertise as you are, but I hope that everybody out there realizes that they should be thinking about these things. And if they haven't taken the steps that you've mentioned to them, that they are reaching out to someone, either you or someone like you. Some of this stuff is state specific when it comes to asset planning, estate planning, et cetera. So you obviously want to talk to somebody knowledgeable in your state, depending on what you're doing. But these are very global issues. I just looked at a contract earlier today where the doctor's practice is being acquired and the insurance that he's going to be given as an employee is something like, you know, $750,000 or something like that, which, and I'm in Illinois, hospital medical staff privileges require at least $1.3 million. So I'm kind of curious. And one of the questions I have is, well, what hospital are you going to that allows this type of coverage? You know, why is it below kind of the expectation of the $1.3 million? Is that coming out of your pocket? So, you know, I think we tend to trust, if you're working for somebody, you tend to trust that the employer's looking out for you as well. And that's something that you shouldn't necessarily do. You should be asking lots of questions because the only one looking out for you is you. And your personal advisors, not your employer, not the employer's advisors. And I think that's something particularly young doctors or just doctors who are working for an organization for a long time and just assume, you know, they're being taken care of. So I think these are great points and I really appreciate you sharing them.
You bet. And I couldn't agree with you more on the, you know, what you said about young physicians. A lot of the physicians that I work with have been in practice for many years and already have a significant amount of wealth and success. But sometimes that when I'm doing a CME presentation on these issues, for instance, I'll say that the smartest physicians I work with are the ones that come to us right out of medical school where they don't really have any significant wealth yet, but they're planning to. And a lot of what we tell them to do is exactly that proactive risk management you're talking about. We tell them, get a disability policy. You're 5 times more likely to be disabled than to die before the age of 65. Get a heavy duty umbrella policy on your home and your vehicle, right? You don't want to start your career with a multi-million dollar judgment or $1 million judgment on a car accident where somebody was injured or killed. Make sure that you have a basic estate plan in place. Make sure that if there are folks depending on you or who have helped, for instance, guarantee, who have signed as guarantors on your med school loans, maybe go out and buy a life insurance policy on yourself to protect mom and dad on that cosigner liability for that medical school debt, right?
Absolutely.
Lots of different simple risk management that can be part of this and lots of things that fall through the cracks. So talking to somebody who will run you through a checklist, much like you might do with your own patients, is important.
I think that's excellent advice. All right, well, we have to wrap up. We're short on time now. Are there any final comments that you want to share with us? I think we've really covered a full realm here.
Sure. I think, we've covered a lot of different issues. I would just reiterate that it's important that physicians avoid the most common fatal mistakes that we see in asset protection planning. The biggest mistake most people make in protecting their wealth is that they do nothing and they wait until a crisis to react. The second most common mistake is using the wrong tools, relying on a revocable trust to provide asset protection when that's not what it was designed to do is one example. Don't do things like dragging liability back into your practice. Don't lease the vehicle that you and your spouse or your children drive every day through the practice because that makes your practice a defendant if there's an accident. All right, so there's some basic things like that. Timing is the most important thing. Certainly, it is important that you act while you can and that you take some steps to segregate your assets and your liabilities.
Great. Well, thank you, Ike Devji, for joining us. And we're going to have all your contact information when we share this. This has been really helpful. And it's a topic that I myself, you know, really don't know as much about as I should. And I feel really educated now after hearing you talk. So thank you all for joining us. If you want to see some of our other podcasts, you can check them out at ralaw.com. And you can catch us next time on the Health Law Hotspot. Thanks for joining us.
The Retzel Health Law Hotspot is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Retzel Health Law Hotspot does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Retzel Health Law Hotspot should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.